Nice to see all of you here. Chance to share the Dharma together. So I'll begin with a little anecdote that reminds me a little bit of the topic we touched in on just naturally in we were talking beforehand. And that is that some of you may know Aloka Vihara, which is a nun's monastery in Placerville, founded by two nuns, or at least it was. It's closed in 2023 after about 10 years. And that was, you know, just the latest incarnation. Before that, they were in San Francisco, and or that maybe in England. So, but now they're moving in different directions, the two nuns who founded it. And one of them, Ayasantachitta, has started a rather different center, which is right near you in Marin County. And the other one, Ayananda Bodhi, has gone on a year-long sabbatical. And she's taking this year to realign and reconsider and see what arises. So, you know, can you imagine how easy it would be to slip into unskillful or difficult emotions and mind states at a time like this? But instead, listen to what she wrote in this month's newsletter. This caught my eye recently. She writes, "Always, nature is teaching the Dhamma in both beautiful and terrible ways, reminding us that all things are ever-changing, that trying to hold on to what is changing can only lead to dukkha, and that what we take to be me and mine has to be let go of. It can feel like a hard teaching when we're holding on to how we think things should be or how we wish them to be. But when we align with this truth, we may find an unexpected peace that can influence the world in deeply meaningful ways." So she's letting go of a lot, you know, the vision of her monastery as a training ground for new nuns. That didn't really work out. She's letting go of a long-time collaboration with the other nun and her literal and spiritual home for a long time. She's letting go of all of that. And yet her mind is not falling completely into things like anger, wanting things to be different, lethargy, regret, or doubt of her abilities. She even says at the end that there's some peace that we can feel during this change, and it's something that might have a beneficial effect on the world. So even now, she's still seeing beyond the personal, despite this large personal event happening for her. So how is it that her mind can incline toward wisdom and peace at a time like this? So, I mean, of course, she's a deep practitioner, but nonetheless, I would like to frame this as a real world application, an example of the Buddha's teachings on two reciprocal ways that our mind can operate. So one is to be mired in what are called the five hindrances, which actively block both calm and wisdom. And the other is to operate from seven beautiful qualities that are based in the heart. And he called those the seven factors of awakening. So we might ordinarily think of kind of an oppositional relationship. And it is true that as one of those sets goes up, the other one goes down. But I think maybe a more helpful image can come from the Pali word for the hindrances. Pali being the ancient Indian language of the Buddhist texts. And that word is nivarana, which literally means a covering, something that covers over. So the hindrances cover over the goodness of the mind, which includes the factors of awakening. So as we clear those away, then what's underneath can shine forth, like sweeping the muck off the surface of water. And then we can see the clarity below that. So I think this might be a better way to frame this relationship between the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. So let's pause for a moment there and consider that. Very often people have an antagonistic relationship to the challenges that are thrown up by the mind during meditation. We get upset that we can't calm down or stop thinking, or that we're feeling so restless or sleepy. And then we doubt ourselves and criticize our ability. It's such a natural pattern that we can get sucked into. But what if instead we had this image that these things that are happening in our mind or in our meditation are simply surface level phenomena? And all they're doing, like waves on a lake or muck on a lake surface, and all they're doing is obscuring the depths that are there anyway. But we're just not seeing at this moment the depths that are kind of awaiting, if we can tap into them, if you will. So with an image like that, I think it's much easier to take the hindrances lightly, not so personally, and to have confidence that the goodness of the mind can indeed be uncovered. The seven factors of awakening, despite their kind of lofty name, I think are not far off attainments, and nor are they something that we have to huff and puff to create. Rather, they are discovered, literally, right? Discovered, uncovered, they're discovered as we gently reduce the surface muck. After that, there is, yes, still a process of cultivating them to be stronger and deeper. But I think the initial connection to them is pretty accessible. And we'll talk about in a moment what these lists are, in case you're not familiar with those. We'll get to that. So, it's a natural question then. How does one move from the surface down to the deeper levels? What helps to thin out these states that are covering over our beautiful mind? In the teachings of the Buddha, there are, of course, a lot of different factors that affect that. But there is one key factor among a bunch of supplementary ones that kind of determines whether you're floating on the surface layer or diving down under it. And that factor is the quality of our attention. So it does matter what we're paying attention to. I'm not saying it doesn't, but there's this additional factor of how our attention is. And the Buddha emphasized that we need to have not just any old attention, but a kind of wise attention or careful attention or skillful attention. One teacher even says profound attention. We'll talk about this in a little while. First, I want to talk about these mind states. So that's really important, is to understand the difference, what it is, the distinguishing feature between hanging around on the surface and potentially diving down farther to what's underneath that. So the mind states that cloud the surface of our lake are ones that tend to make the mind either narrow or scattered. They never support the mind in feeling clear or open or spacious. Okay, the Buddha grouped these into a set of five, which I think covers the territory pretty well. Each one is meant to be kind of a category that includes a bunch of things, related things. So the five categories are sensual desire and its ilk, ill will, sluggishness and laziness, sometimes sloth and torpor, but I kind of like sluggishness and laziness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. So you can easily find advice about how to work with all of these five, and some of it I think is quite good. But I do find myself intrigued that in the teachings, when the Buddha steps back to explain how these five come about, what are the supporting factors, he always names unwise attention, among other things. So tonight we'll look at this aspect more carefully. So the hindrances come about because we're paying attention to experience in an unskillful way. The experience just is what it is, but how we attend to it has different effects. Another story. One time I was riding in a car as a passenger, and we were going downhill on a steep, curvy mountain road. And the mountain was on our left, so that meant that the right lane was on the outer edge by the drop-off. And so we were going down this road. And suddenly, as we went around a curve, there was a motorcycle that was coming up the mountain the other way. And the motorcycle was going a little bit too fast. And on that curve, he swung kind of wide and didn't hit the car, but got very close. It was like closer than we would have wanted. It was like zoom, you know, this motorcycle got very close to the car. And one person in the car exclaimed, "Oh, I hope he's careful." So that's interesting, right? Is that a response like that can only come from wise attention, from paying wise attention. That person was paying attention to the experience in a skillful way. It was essentially the same outer conditions for all of us in the car. I'm pretty sure we were all paying attention to the same, roughly the same outer conditions. But some people were wrapped up in fear or something, and they might have reacted angrily to the motorcycle, somewhat reckless driving that it was doing. But this person was attending with care and wisdom, and so they could simply say, "Oh, I hope he's careful." That was what came to mind. So what might come to mind for you in such a situation? And I think it's the same thing, you know, in all kinds of other situations, like our breaking our favorite teapot or losing a job, losing a pet. It even applies to positive things like getting an award. We could relate to that wisely, or we might get inflated with conceit, right? So there's all kinds of opportunities. So what we're saying here is that it matters how we pay attention to something. Do we make it all about us? Do we project a complex story about what it means? Or do we take it simply as the unfolding of life, as one more opportunity to be helpful to the world or to ourselves? So the five hindrances, desire, ill will, sluggishness, restlessness, and doubt, are strengthened by unwise attention. So that if you're having ongoing trouble with a hindrance, you might look at how you're paying attention. Are you feeding it in some way? So then what about the beautiful qualities of mind that are summarized in these seven factors of awakening? So in that case, it's just the converse. These qualities are strengthened when we attend to experience wisely. So what are they? The seven factors of awakening are mindfulness, wise distinction, energy, joy, tranquility or calm, collectedness, and equanimity. So we're not going to go through all of them in detail, but those represent the ways that the mind, generally they represent the ways that the mind can be helpfully energized and helpfully calm, all while being alert. Does that make sense? So there's this balance, you know, helpful energy, helpful calm, and alertness. They aren't that obscure, actually, again, despite their lofty name. I think everybody here knows what mindfulness is, and your practice is about strengthening that quality in you day by day. Many of you have practiced for at least a while, and some of you for quite a long while. And then wise distinction, that means that you have some ability to see the different things going on in your mind. You can see thoughts and emotions and body sensations and distinguish between them. That's a pretty natural result of mindfulness. Probably we've all experienced some moments of calm and equanimity, maybe even joy or happiness during our meditation, at least sometimes. So I think you're familiar with these good qualities of heart. And these become, more available anytime the hindrances are getting weak or thinned out. We don't have the hindrances 24/7. Really, we don't. We experience many times during the day when we're not completely caught up. And the Buddha points out that at those times, it's useful to pay attention to how our mind feels. It feels open, it feels soft, it feels spacious at such times. What are these qualities like for us? It's so easy just to rush on to the next problem when we're in a state of relative ease, right? What's the next thing I have to do? What's the next thing on my checklist? Where's that pain in my back? Is it still there? As soon as something lets up, we're looking for the next problem. So the obsessively problem-seeking mind is actually associated with unwise attention. Wise attention can see difficulties. It sees dukkha just fine. But it also includes noticing whatever degree of good qualities are available, whether calmness or clear seeing or balance or contentment or simply mindfulness, knowing that mindfulness is present. So actually, let's do that right now. So please, in your mind, call up the quality of mindfulness. Are you mindful right now? Are you aware? Probably yes. It's probably super, probably pretty easy to do that. So now you know for yourself that mindfulness is present in your mind. Really feel that sense that it brings, sense what kind of a feeling it brings to know that. Usually there's some kind of ease. For me, knowing that I know is kind of a sparkly feeling sometimes. So right now you are practicing wise attention because you have brought into awareness a skillful, beautiful quality of heart. So this is a high quality kind of attention that you have right now. This kind of attention has a name in Pali. It's called yoniso manasikara. And manasikara means literally done in the mind, and it's often translated as attention. Yoniso is a more subtle word. It's always positive, and it gets translated in this phrase, usually as wise, as I've been using it, but also skillful or careful. But if we look, yoni literally means a womb or sometimes root. And so there's one teacher who translates this term as radical attention. Radical being another word for root, right? Like in square root, you make a radical. Those words come from the same root. So radical attention, you kind of like that. My teacher, Gil Fronsdal, says profound attention. So there's something important about this kind of attention. I think at a basic level, it's okay to see yoniso manasikara as attention that works well. That is, it doesn't feed the hindrances and it keeps the mind on track. If you want to think that, that's good enough. But we can do better than that also. Remember the image that we started with, the lake that has surface waves or surface muck along with quieter depths. So the hindrances are on the surface, covering things over, and when that's cleared away, we can somehow dive beneath it, and then we find the beauty below that was obscured. Okay, so that was what we started with. So what if we thought about yoniso manasikara as attention that comes from the depths? It's not outside the range of what those words could mean. So attention that comes from the depths. So an attention that is rooted in our good heart, in our best qualities of mind. And this contrasts with the tension that's flitting around on the surface level of the mind, just amplifying whatever's on the surface. But this deep attention can come from below, strengthening these good qualities that we all carry. So what does that mean practically? For me, being able to intend to experience from a deeper place happens when I'm in touch with my own deeper values, for example. It happens when I'm in touch with my trust in the practice, when I'm in touch with my wish to walk the Buddhist path. When I remember those things, then I'm coming from Yoniso Manasikara. So I think the choice is ours to some degree. Experience is just coming in, and we really don't have total control over that, in case you hadn't noticed. But we can connect internally with our faith, our values, our best intentions, and that will help us to meet experience in ways that reduce the five hindrances and nourish the seven factors of awakening. So it can be as simple as saying the refuges every morning before you go to work or before you go out. I thought it was just lovely that we said them today before our sit, so, and that you have a practice of doing that in this Sangha. I think, what I understand, that would be a way to actually have fewer hindrances during the sit, if you can bear that in mind, because you would be more likely to have wise attention. You could also, other practical tips, taking 10 seconds before you walk into a meeting to remember that you want to be kind, connecting with your deepest values. Then you can forget that and go in and just, do the meeting normally. You don't have to sit there and obsessively hold on to that thought, but you condition the mind with that intention before you go in. Or even, bringing attention to the heart area while driving on a curvy road. That might be helpful to keep the mind, anything that keeps the mind in a good place, if you will. So if we practice that way, we try to enhance the quality of our attention, then when there's some change in our life, whether something, the usual things of life, or something big like our monastery closing, rather than reacting from the surface, we can kind of have a sense the next step is welling up from the depths below. We can get out of the way and kind of feel into how the Dharma will flow next. At least that's how it feels for me. I have less need to kind of try to do when I'm coming from wise attention to try to get in there and manipulate and control things, but more ability to flow with things and sense like, oh, what needs to happen next, and be able to do that. That kind of attention that comes from the depths is more clear and stable and able to do that rather than reacting from one of our surface qualities. It works in individual instances, like being in a conversation, and it also works as a guide for living. Now, it works in our larger choices that we make about how our life flows. If we can come from a place of wise attention, we'll be more likely to make good decisions. So it's a beautiful way to live, and it is how an awakened life unfolds. So doing this, changing the quality of our attention and really committing to coming from that place requires a certain sensitivity to the energies and processes that are going on within. We have to feel in the moment how our heart feels, how our body feels, what's going through our mind, and use that at least somewhat as a guide. Now, if we're not fully awakened, there is some delusion there some of the time. So, we still may not be perfect, and we still certainly don't have control as we, to make everything the way we want. But nonetheless, if we listen carefully to the heart and the gut and the mind, we can more often flow in ways that are bringing us along the path, essentially. We listen carefully in our mind and can discern the difference between movements that are surface level and movements that are deep. And when we tap into this, it's kind of like a wellspring that can inform our life, can almost guide our life. So I wish you all the ability to tap into this wellspring through the Onisa Manasikara and through discerning when we're coming more from the hindrances, the surface level, and when we've cleared that away and have the beautiful qualities of mind and heart present. So this is, these are my thoughts at this time. I wanted to leave space for discussion and questions you might have. What's on your mind at this point? Yeah, Mary.
So I was just did a day online retreat, and one of the things we were talking about is the seven factors of awakening. And it's so this is very nice that you did this. And one of the things that I liked, and I would wonder what your view on it was, they were talking about how some that there's the mindfulness, and then you have the it's there's you called it, I guess he called it investigation, and I guess I just remember I was with Gil did one too, and it was the mindfulness. And I have this on paper and I keep it in my house. And he had these questions. Mindfulness was being here. Investigation was what? And it's like, is this an ouch or a moment? But not to do a story. And then the effort was kind of like your energy that you would use. And he said this, and he said, and how to put effort in, not to do striving, but to have it be more natural. And then the joy, he said, was yes, and to be present. And then the tranquility was ease. And the concentration, he said, steady. And equanimity was that it was okay. But he was talking about, and this is not always so easy for me, about how to balance the first, there's mindfulness, how to balance the first three factors that kind of give you energy, and how to balance the other ones that are the calming. So I was thinking about what you were saying with the different hindrances. You know, it's like, what would be like for sloth and torpor, like what, like for the different hindrances that come up, what would be a good awakening factor you would suggest to kind of call forth, put your, like, bring your attention to call forth to kind of help deal with them? Because I mean, that for me, sometimes it's just, for me, my practice is trying to find a balance.
Yeah.
Trying to find some kind of balance. And so I was very intrigued with these and just your thoughts on how to find a balance with the hindrances and what you might suggest besides, I mean, wise attention and thinking about which one of these factors you might want to, you can't make it happen, but what might you ask for? What might you try to evoke or call for?
Yeah. Wow. This is a large, but I like the way you've structured it. So for those of you who aren't as familiar with the seven factors of awakening, Mary has highlighted the way that they're in two different sets. There's mindfulness, which is kind of the overarching one. And then the next three, investigation, I called it wise distinction. Energy and joy are energizing factors of mind. And then tranquility, collectedness, and equanimity, sometimes concentration, are calming factors of mind. And there's a practice where once you have all of the seven established, you keep the mind on track by not having too much energy and not having too much calm, but keeping those balanced so that the mind is alert, but also calm. Okay, so, and then it's also true, So let me say that you've highlighted two different kinds of balance. You use the word balance, but one balance is the balance where as the five hindrances go up, the seven factors of awakening go down. It's like a teeter-totter. I use the lake image because I like it better, but some teachers use that image. So that's one kind of balance. And then the balance of the awakening factors among themselves is a different kind of balance. So that one, you actually, if you find that there's too much of one, you want to enhance the ones that are not present. So they go up together. They're not a teeter-totter. So just so you have that image. But you asked about hindrances and factors of awakening balancing each other. So, it's fairly clear that wise distinction counteracts doubt. Wisdom and doubt are opposites, and sloth and torpor and energy counteract each other directly. But the other ones, you have five balanced against seven, so they don't line up one to one. So I would instead request that you don't get too tangled up in that. One of the unbalancing factors of the mind is having too much information and applying too much theory. So for me, balance is about is wordless, and it's about energy in the body and the mind. So I quiet all that thinking. I'm not thinking about which one have I got, up all seven, five, this, that, up, down. Forget it. Just establish wise attention, settle the body energy, and then like the way when a bird flies, it knows how to not veer off to one side by staying balanced. It's much more visceral that way. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And for me, a lot of it is just the felt sense of it.
Yeah, that's the way
Yeah,
to do it.
and I agree. Yeah, but I just wanted to get your take on it. And I sat with Gil doing this, and then I've sat with other teachers, and it's always interesting to see a different teacher, a different perspective opens up something different for me. So thank
Great.
you.
Nice. Yeah, Barbara, your hand is up.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for that image of the surface versus the depth. Because I've been working a lot with being in touch with my deepest values, and it's really done a lot of profound things for my practice and health.
Oh, great.
But I can get so caught up in the surface. And I just had an experience being caught up. I lost this little booklet I have to have for medical reasons, and I just freaked out. And then I suddenly realized that was what I was doing. I was just like thrashing around on the surface. And to be able to have that sense of mindfulness of the surface, I think is going to be very helpful for me, because
Great.
I need that sense, some kind of image of, well, where am I now? And without just getting lost in the reactivity. And that, so I found that very helpful for me.
Excellent. Yeah, every time we reconnect with mindfulness, we're taking that journey a little bit below the surface. Yeah, nice. Thank you. Mary Page.
Yeah, I really love this as well, and I think the piece that I like that I my question really is how to remember to do it. I guess that's and the idea of maybe saying the refuges more often. And what was the other thing that you said? I can't remember now, but
Connecting with a wise intention can be
yeah.
good. Yeah. Connecting physically with the heart area. I gave several options because sometimes people can connect in different ways.
Yeah, it seems like that's the key, is just being having some reminders to, okay,
Yeah, finding something that works for you. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That's wonderful. I appreciate that a lot. Thank you.
Great.
Wanted to thank you for the seaweed.
Oh, Jen, yeah, the image in the guided meditation.
Yeah,
Yeah.
my head felt so wonderfully light. I just was bobbling around. Thank you. I'm going to use it in future sits.
Oh, good. Yeah. The sea plant anchored to the sea floor.
Right, right. But my head was the bubble at the top instead of some kind of heavy old weight. I was just
oh,
bobbing.
good.
Thank you.
Delightful. Yeah, Deborah. You're still muted.
I say thank you too for the topic of this is so synchronistic. It's been a very synchronistic few days. I've been trying to stay engaged with my desire, my aspiration to just stay in my heart area and to remember to be kind outwardly as much as possible, but also inwardly.
Okay, yeah.
So when you talked about going deeper, I have been finding that for the last little bit of time here. If I can just remember that, and lately I've been able to remember that more. So I've been delighted that even
nice.
When I'm a little bit irritable or irritated or just not feeling well or whatever, that remembering is closer. It's closer at hand. So I don't know if that means I've been practicing long enough or I'm just getting old and tired or all of that, but I really appreciated that you talked about, I loved the review of the seven factors of enlightenment. I've heard it as the seven factors of enlightenment. I love that review. So thank you for that too. But this talking about, yeah, because I have to remind myself a lot of times during the day not to be caught up in my to-do list. And my cousin calls it her to-don't list because so much of it doesn't get done. And just to be accepting of what's really happening in this moment and what's possible and to be kind. So thank you. This is very cogent and very helpful.
Well, you're very welcome. I would say that the greater accessibility you have to kindness and the depths and so forth is the fruit of carrying that intention over some time. It starts to bear fruit at some point.
I hope so. Thank you.
Anything else? Yeah, Karina.
Thank you, Kim. That was really great. I'm having a difficult time. I'm having a lot of things. So many things that to have happen at the same time. Some people who are dying, some elders with dementia. I'm laid up for the last 10 days. I can't be on my foot. Like it's just so many things. And the beginning of what you said about just, and I know this so well, but it's so hard to get there, is just accepting that change. I don't know exactly what you said, but I wrote down accepting that change. And then the peace you feel can have an effect on the world. And that was just such a powerful beginning. I was like, ah, I'm in the right place. Because what I find, I 2 weekends ago, before all of this kind of happened, I was on a silent retreat with no technology, by myself, quiet. And I was just so at peace and so happy and so accepting. My meditations, like 3 times a day, were, it was just easy. And as soon as the personalities come around, it's like, I feel guilty. I need to be doing something. And that's the other thing you said that I needed to hear is that it isn't always what we need to do, you know, and taking that moment to just pause, you know, that's everything for me, the pause, because if I just act from how I'm feeling, like how my emotions are in the moment, I'm going to be in trouble because I'm going to probably need to go left and I'm going right. So, yeah, you gave me a lot to think about. And, but like you said, not to get too heady about it either. You know, it's not a complicated thing. It's really the simplest thing is the answer. So, thank you so much. It was really good timing for me tonight.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, sometimes coming out of retreat is right when we get hit with all these things. And it's exactly so that we have a chance to see them, like the Dharma is giving us this. But one thing I want to highlight from what you said is that you mentioned something about the self and the emotions and so forth. That's all surface level. The self is actually pretty, at least the outward self is a pretty surface level phenomena. We have, of course, subtle roots that go way down to conceit, but like the personality. And when we're on retreat, we can dip down below that and we don't need to be anybody. And it doesn't, you know, these things get kind of smoothed out. And then often coming off of a retreat, when our roles come back, when our relationships come back, that's when we see the personality arising again. And if we can just take a moment to see how that process forms, it can be so helpful in lightening up on some of those states. So I love that you mentioned that you saw that.
Mm. Thank you.
Or potentially saw that. You at least saw the way things come back. And recognizing that that's the self, just the self turning itself back on, gives us the crucial wisdom that it's not always there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And best wishes for all the challenges that are in your life right now. Your practice is supportive.
Thank you.